Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Joseph O'Neill read his story, The Sinking of the Houston, from the October 30th, 2017 issue of the magazine. O'Neill has published four novels, including Netherland, which won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction in 2009, and The Dog, which came out in 2014. Now here's Joseph O'Neill.
The Sinking of the Houston. When I became a parent of young children, I also became a purposeful and relentless opportunist of sleep. In fact, sleep functioned as that period's subtle denominator. I found myself capable of taking a nap just about anywhere, even when standing in a subway car or riding an escalator. I wasn't the only one. Out and about, I spotted drowsy or dozing people everywhere, and I realized that a kind of mechanized mass somnambulism is an essential component of modern life, and I gained a better understanding of the siesta and the snooze and the death wish. Then the three boys grew big, grew from toddling alarmists into wayward urban doofuses, neurologically unequipped to perceive the risks incidental to their teenage lives. Several nights a week, I lie awake in bed until the front door has sighed shut behind every last one of them. Even then, even once they're all safely home, there are disquieting goings-on. Objects are put in motion to frightening sonic effect. A creaking cupboard hinge is an SOS. A spoon in a cereal bowl is a toxin. The key point is that I no longer have the ability to nap at will, to recover, in nickels of unconsciousness, a lost hypnotic legacy. A round-the-clock jitteriness prevails. As a consequence, the concept of peace and quiet has assumed an italicized personal importance. Who can say, of course, what peace and quiet means? It certainly doesn't denote the experience produced by being by oneself. I can offer only a subjective definition. The state of affairs in which, one finds oneself at home. Two, there are people around whom one wants to have around, not least because it means that one doesn't have to worry about where else they might be. Three, one sits in one's armchair. And four, the people around leave one alone. The phenomenon of the dad chair needs no investigation here. I'll just state that there comes a moment when the whole business of taking care of the guys, of their need to be woken up, clothed, fed, transported, coached, cleaned, bedded down, constantly kept safe, and constantly captained, altered me. The alteration made me identified with the shipman working in high and howling winds in the Bay of Biscay, who dreams of the bathtubs of La Rochelle. This led me to buy a black leatherette armchair and to designate it as my haven. I have to say, it has worked out pretty well. But of late, the 15-year-old, the middle son, has taken to disturbing me. I'll be sitting there doing stuff on my laptop, when he'll approach and pull off my noise-cancelling headphones. "What is it?" I ask him. "Have you heard of the Duvaliers?" "What?" "The Duvaliers, the dictators of Haiti." "What about them?" There's two Duvaliers, he says. There's the father and there's the son. Do you know that they used to rape to punish their political opponents? What? He says, I don't want to hear about it. I know all about the Duvaliers. They were horrible. I know all about it. But, Dad, I'll bet you don't know. There was one time... Stop harassing me, I shout. Stop bothering me with this stuff. Leave me alone. I lived through it. I don't want to discuss it. He answers in his mild way, You didn't exactly live through it. You just heard about it. I understand that my son is trying to get a precise sense of the world he is about to enter, the wide world. I understand that this can be a difficult process. I understand that it's a good thing that he comes to me with these questions, which do him nothing but credit, and that these are golden moments that must be savored. I understand all that. Note that my 15-year-old is a distinct case, but not a special one. His two brothers are the same. Each, in his own way, threatens the peace and the quiet. Where is East Timor? This particular son asks me. Look it up, I say. His voice has arrived from his bedroom where he's lying in his bunk bed in a t-shirt and tracksuit bottoms and skateboarding socks, reading his phone. Sometimes he'll come out of the bedroom and sit on the arm of my armchair and cast an eye over my screen while he talks. Which is exasperating. What I do online is my business. He calls out, Do you know who Charles Taylor is? I'm not answering that. He comes out of the brothers' room, which is what we call the space in which the three boys are cooped up. He was a guerrilla leader in Liberia. He had an army made up of children. Stop right there, I say. My son stops where he is because he thinks I'm telling him that he should stop advancing. Toward me. From a distance of about 3 yards, he says, He made the children do some really bad things. Really, really bad things. He made them shoot their own parents. I think Taylor may have been the worst of them all. I remove my reading glasses and look him in the eye. C'est la vie, I tell him. In my book, this is an undervalued maxim. It is related to Stoicism, a too neglected philosophy nowadays, and it's related, emotionally more than logically, to the idea of water under the bridge, which reminds us that the past cannot be rectified. This impossibility applies to the present, too. The present is necessarily beyond rectification. If you think about it, the very notion of rectification makes almost no sense. You could even contend that one's future is water under the bridge. Anyhow, on a Sunday evening, the 15-year-old, my second-born, my secondo, comes home and announces that he's been mugged. I'm in my chair when this occurs. I inspect him, this kid who is nearly 6 feet tall and forces me onto my toes when I kiss him, which is something I often do, even though it can embarrass him a little. He seems composed, but he also looks as if he's just been mugged. Are you hurt? I say. He shakes his head. Tell me what happened, I say. He was skating with friends at LES, the skate park under the Manhattan Bridge. Then the three of them took a train into Brooklyn. They wanted to skate a spot where guys like Tyshawn Jones and Brandon Westgate and Alex Olsen had recently filmed some tricks. They overshot their stop. That was when they ran into trouble. Which train is this, I say. I don't know, some train. In the old days, this would have thrown me, would have led me to wonder what kind of knucklehead doesn't know which train he's on. But I've been a father of boys for quite a while. He likes tea, this son. I've been making him some while he's been talking. He takes the tea. To repeat, there were three of them. My son, plus his two friends. Three young males. They were sitting in the back corner of the subway car. The car was almost empty, it being a Sunday afternoon. There was this dude close by, sitting between the boys and the doors. The dude had a bag. The dude said to them, "You want to buy a gun?" He opened his bag and showed them the gun. The kids indicated that they didn't want to buy a gun. The dude told the kids to get their wallets out and put them in his bag. He spoke in a low, calm voice. The other passengers, the potential witnesses or interveners or heroes, were quite a ways down the car. They weren't aware of what was happening. The kids did as they were told. Then the dude told them to show them their phones. They obeyed. I asked my son for a description of the dude. My son tells me that he was a black guy, older, maybe about 30, hard to say how old exactly. He wasn't fat or big or small. He wore a Yankees cap. He had tattoos on his forearms. These were gang markings or prison markings, my son tells me, as if he or his friends would have a clue. The criminal eyed the three phones. My son's phone was brand new. His was the one the criminal reached for. The criminal asked my son for his passcode. My son told him. The criminal entered the passcode and changed it. He didn't ask the other boys for their phones. The criminal told my son that he had all of his personal information now and knew where to find him. He said to the three boys, "I never want to see you again, understand?" Here the train came to a stop. The criminal got out. "He really knew what he was doing," I say. "Yeah," my son says. I say, "It would have been crazy to take any chances. You did the right thing." "Yeah," my son says. "Don't worry about your phone. We'll get you another one. We may even have insurance to cover that. But we'd need to report it." "No cops," my son says. And this is when I see that the criminal has frightened him very much and figures in his mind as a person of great powers. "Okay," I say. I give him a hug and a kiss. "You did well. You handled yourself well, son." I don't call him son very often. It's a big word to say out loud. It's a word I hold back for special occasions. I don't mention that I have already resolved to find this man and break his fucking legs. This isn't a fantasy. My phone has an app that tracks my children's phones. Because children are entitled to privacy, I've never used the app before, but this is an exceptional situation. When I activate the phone tracker, a map of New York City appears. Three circles, one blue, one green, one orange, correspond to the phone's respective whereabouts. It's a thrilling scene for some reason. The stolen phone is the orange one. It's in Brooklyn, at the corner of Saratoga and Pitkin. There's no question of going out there. That wouldn't be smart. I'm going to bide my time. I'm going to wait for the orange circle to come to my turf. My turf is the triangle made by Times Square and Penn Station and the Port Authority bus terminal. Everyone passes through here sooner or later, especially if they're up to no good. What this means in practice is that I spend a lot of time in my chair, grimly chortling at my phone. Orange Circle Guy, or OCG, thinks he's home free. He has no idea that I'm watching his every move. A lot of the day, he's motionless in his Brownsville residence. I know exactly which Amboy Street apartment building he lives in, and typically it's not until the mid-afternoon that he stirs. He doesn't go very far. He just wanders here and there in his neighborhood like a little doggy being taken out to make a number one and a number two. Maybe he owns a doggy. When he catches a subway train, his kinesis assumes a more suspenseful character. The orange circle disappears for a period of minutes and then reappears, usually in downtown Brooklyn or at Fulton Street Station in Lower Manhattan. This loser is so predictable. Occasionally the circle vanishes, at Saratoga Avenue Station and remains undetectable for an hour or two, whereupon it rematerializes at Saratoga Avenue Station. In other words, OCG has never surfaced. He has been underground the whole time. From this fact, I deduce that these outings have a criminal character. He takes an outbound train in order to rob people on the return journey to Brownsville. It's what he does. Once, OCG popped up at Penn Station. In a flash, I was out of the apartment. I was a mere block from my destination when I saw that he'd already boarded a train. To Albany, it turned out. That was a near miss. But my day will come. I can get so caught up in my stakeout that I let my guard down. The son in question says to me, "Do you know what vivisection is?" "Vivisection?" "Operating on live animals, as a scientific experiment." I say, "I don't like where this is going." "Have you heard of Unit 731? "Unit of what?" I say. He tells me, and this is news to me, that during the Second World War, the Japanese conducted lethal vivisectional experiments on hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, most of them Chinese. This took place in a facility known as Unit 731. At the end of the war, the scientist murderers were secretly granted immunity from prosecution and even from exposure by the United States. In exchange, the United States received sole possession of the results of the vivisections. Evidently, the data was valuable in the field of biological warfare. "Yeah," I say, "not good." "That actually happened," the boy says. I say, "I don't know what to tell you." Which isn't quite true. I know not to tell him or remind him that some of the children abducted and militarized by Charles Taylor reportedly learned not only to murder their parents, but also to perform vivisections. On encountering a pregnant woman, they were known to bet on the gender of the unborn child and then using a machete to cut open the mother's womb in order to determine the winner of the bet. There's a chance, of course, that OCG might not be my guy. OCG could be a purchaser of the phone. Given everything I've seen and studied, that strikes me as unlikely. No, the bitch has got himself a mint phone for his personal use. Or so he thinks. Like every criminal, he has overlooked a detail. That kid he threatened and robbed, that kid is my son. When the boys were little, we found ourselves in an airport lounge. We were delayed for a few hours. It was nighttime. Volatile colored lights moved in the dark of the windows, and the boys and I spent quite some time looking at them. After a while, the kids began horsing around. They were being boys, being juvenile male humans between the ages of 3 and 6, to be zoological about it. A certain boisterousness and brouhaha characterized their activities. From my seat, I somnolently kept watch on them, breaking things up as needed and rounding up whichever one went astray. A couple was seated nearby. The man turned to me and said, "Control your children." Instantly, I was 100% awake. I rose to my feet and went over to this man. I pointed my finger an inch or two from his nose. "I'm going to control you," I said. We didn't hear from him after that. Now, it's true that the guy must have been close to 60. He posed no obvious physical threat. It was no big deal to put him in his place. But something deeper was going on, something beyond calculations of relative physical strength. "You don't mess with my children. Not when I'm around. I don't care who you are. You don't take one fucking step in their direction." What I'm getting at is, I have latent paternal powers. It may be said, and in truth it is said, by a whispering imaginary skeptic, that there's no way a 51-year-old man can take down a tattooed career criminal, a hoodlum Moriarty, 20 years his junior. To which I respond, let's wait and see. My next-door neighbour is a gentleman by the name of Eduardo. Over the years, he has kept himself to himself. It's said he's of Cuban origin. He communicates mainly by signifiers of goodwill. For example, sometimes he'll take delivery of a package for me and leave it outside my door. Eduardo's apartment shares plumbing with mine, and if there's a pipe blockage, we liaise about turning taps on and off. I once saw a limousine run him down. He was in the crosswalk. He's pushing 70 and has a slow, hobbling gait. When the limo turned straight into him, I ran over and helped Eduardo get up. There was no sign of an injury. My neighbour, I understood, is hard as nails. On a Friday morning in April, OCG pops up at the Port Authority bus terminal. That's only 5 blocks away. That is squarely in my turf. I jump to my feet, put on a baseball cap and sunglasses, and dash out. I encounter Eduardo at the elevator. We smile at each other. When we exit the building, I hold open the door and wait for him to pass through. Then he speaks. You play baseball? He's referring to the bat I'm holding. I'm going to a meeting, I tell him. I'll walk with you, he says. That okay? Sure, I say. I'm checking my phone. OCG hasn't gone anywhere. To repeat, Eduardo is a steady walker, but a deliberate one. As his escort, I have no choice but to go at his speed. This is a first, I should say. We've never walked together before. In a second first, Eduardo makes an important-sounding announcement. Today is the anniversary of the Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs, huh? The Bay of Pigs, Bunker Hill, Bull Run, the bridge over the River Kwai. Who cares at this point? Who knows how to care? I was 16, Eduardo tells me. He tells me that he was among the troops on the Houston. His best friend there was named Garcilaso. Garcilaso was 15 years old. With that, he has my ear, even as I keep an eye on my phone. Eduardo relates that after his family fled Cuba, he enrolled at Georgia Tech. Wait, I say, you enrolled at 16? Correct, Eduardo says, at 16. He tells me that it was in Atlanta at the YMCA that he was recruited by the counter-revolutionaries. Everybody else was going, he says, so I thought, why not? Let's go. He flew down to Miami to sign up with the CIA. After 2 weeks of training in the mountain jungles of Guatemala, Eduardo and Garcilaso boarded the Houston. They were given ancient Garand rifles. In the absence of helmets, they wore cowboy hats. One morning at dawn, Garcilaso and Eduardo sneaked into the captain's quarters. Garcilaso had heard there were M&Ms in there, Eduardo told me. We look around and we find the M&Ms. At that exact moment, we see the Cuban jets, flying low, coming straight at us. He laughs. He's been laughing softly the whole time. I ask Eduardo if he and Garcilaso got to eat the M&Ms. He tells me they did not. It seems that this is the full extent of his anecdote. Only in response to my questioning does he disclose that the bombing sank the ship. Eduardo had to jump overboard into the Bay of Pigs and swim to shore. Anybody die? I ask. Sure, Eduardo says. We've reached the end of the block. I'm headed uptown, I say. Eduardo indicates that he's also headed that way. We set off. In the morning rush, this bit of 8th Avenue is barely manageable on foot. The problem is that an almost impenetrable pedestrian mass discharged by buses from New Jersey and the Times Square subway exits hurries south in a kind of stampede. The sense of a great flight, of crops put to the torch, of a ruined and shaken hinterland, is only heightened by trains booming underfoot, by the bleeping klaxons of reversing box trucks, by the disorderly shoving of food carts between the stopped cars, and above all, by the strangely focusless expressions worn by the oncoming commuters, who are seemingly devoid of ordinary consciousness. It all bodes ill. Either the barbarians are at the gates, or we ourselves are the barbarians. What I'd give for a green and silent lane. What I'd give for a woodland's leopard skin light. In short, Eduardo and I go forward only in starts. We advance a few yards, wait for a gap in the crowd, and advance again. I notice that he's trying to tell me something. "Say again," I shout. An ambulance siren is shrieking. Eduardo waits for the shriek to pass. "I'm going in there to get a coffee," he says. It feels natural to follow Eduardo, even though I'm averse to this particular deli, which I know to be a busy, cavernous, impersonal establishment with an offhand staff. When Eduardo sits at the little countertop by the window, I join him, but I don't get myself anything to drink. I listen when he tells me that a small group of them, a handful of the survivors of the sinking of the Houston, walked for a day and a night through the swamps. On the second day, they surrendered to Castro's forces, and en route to Havana, they ran into Che. Che Guevara? The prisoner transport vehicle had come to an unexpected halt. Che Guevara and a woman comrade appeared. They examined the prisoners and conferred in French, so as not to be understood. Finally, Che said to Eduardo, "Who are you, young man?" Eduardo answered, "Eduardo Sanchez de Cadenas." Che said, "Are you a relation of Captain Cadenas?" "I have no idea," Eduardo said. "I was relaxed," he tells me. "My attitude was they were going to shoot us or they weren't." The older prisoners were not so relaxed. Unlike Eduardo, they'd recognized Che. "Shut up, kid," they said. Nobody got shot. The truck drove on. Eduardo never saw Che Guevara again. "What about your friend?" I ask. "What about Garcilaso?" Eduardo shakes his head. Or rather, he moves his head in such a way that I don't know what he's signaling. I'm afraid to know. Then Eduardo says, "Garcilaso was okay. And by God, that's a very beautiful thing to hear." For a minute or two, we watch the world go by. "You want another coffee?" I say. "I'm getting myself one." "I'm okay," Eduardo says. "You don't need to be anywhere?" "Do I need to be anywhere? What kind of question is that? Of course I need to be somewhere. There is no end to the places I need to be." I buy myself a coffee. Then I regain my stool. "Tell me more," I want to say to Eduardo, but do not say, because he seems ready to leave. "Tell me about Garcilaso and about how things went well for him."
That was Joseph O'Neill reading his story, The Sinking of the Houston. O'Neill's books include the nonfiction family history, Blood Dark Track. This is his third story in the magazine. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Matthew Clam reads Twin Beds in Rome by John Updike. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice in Apple Podcasts on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.